Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jeffrey Bristol. I am a host on the channel. Today we'll be speaking with Professor James Holmes about his book, A Brief Guide to Maritime Strategy. A Brief Guide is a readable introduction to the world of maritime strategy. While he bases his narratives on the writings of Mahan and Corbett, Professor Holmes weaves in a wide range of maritime, political, and philosophical thinkers to describe the importance of maritime strategy for any nation. His book guides junior officers and sailors in the art of strategic thinking and action. Professor Holmes outlines the global importance of maritime strategy, emphasizing how it supports all of a nation's endeavors, not just during war, but especially at peace. It forms an indispensable introduction to naval essentials and serves as a companion to more contemporary writers like Geoffrey Till and Wayne Hughes. In this discussion, Professor Holmes and I cover a variety of topics, including the interaction between maritime strategy and culture, the importance of naval strategy for the peacetime world, China's naval development and strategic needs, as well as how naval strategy differs from and overlaps with the land domain. Thank you, Professor Holmes, for joining us today on the New Books Network. How are things up in Rhode Island?
Oh, things are fine up in Rhode Island for the most part. I mean, given that it's obviously an unusual year that is dragging out, we got a nice little blanket of snow on the ground, which is always nice. And we are still mostly virtual at work, so like everybody else, we are camping out at home and doing things from the living room.
I'm sure all the students love not having to press, dry clean, or iron their uniforms.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of yes and no. I think that's probably one upside. But the fact is that a lot of the students have been here. We're going into the last trimester, and many of them have not been on campus, which makes it very difficult, especially for our international students who have come from great distances to attend the War College and have not been able to actually do anything face to face with their colleagues or their faculty or anybody else.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I know a lot of the War College experience is also networking and, you know, your fellow officers. So, especially inter-service international guys. So.
Yeah, I think we've gotten good at using Zoom and other platforms like that to have seminars, but you just can't replace the dynamism that happens in the classroom. I mean, when I'm running a seminar, I'm a scribbler. I write on the board. Pretty much nonstop, and try to make connections and so forth. And there's just no way to replace that. Plus, just not having face to face contact it just takes something away.
Absolutely, absolutely. But hopefully, it makes the writing process all the more important. So, without further ado, I'd love to ask you a couple of questions about the book. So, I know you present this as a primer on maritime strategy. So, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that, and what were some of your objectives in writing the book.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, in the foreword, I actually set it up to explain the logic of what I'm all about. I've sort of made it my mission to try to train midshipmen, newly commissioned officers, people who are very junior at the outset of their careers, to try to acquaint them though with the basics of maritime strategy. We find that officers will show up at the War College at mid-career, either as lieutenant commanders, sort of mid-grade, or even more senior officers, without really ever having studied maritime strategy. And in different accession programs, whether it's OCS, but especially the ROTC programs or the Naval Academy, they get a decent dose of maritime history, U.S. naval history, but they don't actually study the classics. And I'm obviously, as a teacher in the strategy and policy department, a true believer in the value of strategic theory. So the basic idea is to set them up and start acquainting them with these masters of strategy very early on. Not only to help them get a jump ahead on their education, but also just to help them make sense of what they do on a daily basis. I represent the book in the foreword as a letter to my previous self, to myself 30 years ago when I was a junior officer and wondered about why we were doing things like giving ship tours or having congressional delegations on board or whatever the case may be. These are things that are not only valuable, but they're actually diplomatically valuable. Often you have to maintain decent relationships with lawmakers, with foreign partners and friends and so forth. So there's actually a lot to what we do on a daily basis. And the book tries to help these junior officers make sense of it.
Yeah, well, and that's great. You know, it's also continuing a tradition of the Navy War College. I think of all the war colleges, it has the reputation as being the historically, at least the most strategically oriented, and maybe the most intellectual, if I can say that, as a fellow Navy officer myself. So it's great to hear that tradition is continuing over there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's obvious. What we think, we do have that reputation, and I actually believe it's warranted. Although it's kind of hard without spending time at the other war colleges to hold forth too confidently, just because I haven't been there and worked in those departments and dealt with their students. When people are thinking about the war college, it is the Naval War College, but we have a very joint student body. Generally speaking, sort of roughly speaking, in a seminar of 12, which is usually about what they are. Usually about half the naval officers, or half of that 12 is naval officers, but you're always going to have a Marine. You're always going to have at least one Army officer, usually more, an Air Force officer, and then two or three international officers. You're talking about a very cosmopolitan group. Yes, we're the Naval War College, but we also are a very joint school as well.
That's great. So, you know, getting to the book, one of the things that's interesting, I think you accomplish a good goal here, and it's a great introduction. It's very tight, which makes it easy to handle, and it's pretty minimalistic. It's divided into three parts. So I found that kind of struck me, that organization, while I was reading it. So what was your thinking in terms of writing it, and, you know, why did you have this particular organization that you were?
Well, one time Abraham Lincoln was asked how long a man's legs needed to be, and he said long enough to reach the ground. I didn't go into it. In fact, I very seldom these days. I do a lot of writing. I do a lot of writing, not just books, but a lot of short pieces. And a lot of times, I don't even start with an outline. I just sit down and start writing, and whatever the piece of writing is actually writes itself. I think I was a little bit more regimented when I go into a book project, but at the same time, I didn't have some sort of master plan. There's nothing really hidden in the structure of the book that explains its logic. I just basically go through it in the order that seemed best to me. What is the sea? I start off by defining what the sea is, reaching back to Mann's ideas that the sea is it's a wide thoroughfare. It's a nautical highway that we can all use to carry on commerce, which he depicts as the chief purpose of maritime strategy, but also do military stuff such as we're familiar with, not only in wartime, obviously fighting for command of the sea, but also responding to humanitarian disasters in peacetime, doing all these things that navies do when they're not actually engaged in fighting. So I start off and I look at that. I look at geography. Talk about the ideas about where good sites for naval bases are and all related things, and then I start necking down towards what navies actually do on the operational level in peacetime again and in wartime, which obviously is a panoply of stuff, which is actually something interesting for a junior naval officer, is just to understand that navies do a lot more stuff in peacetime than say an Army or an Air Force will, because something about the nature of ships simply suits them for missions like that, and that makes it a broader realm of strategy than you run into with air or ground strategy.
Yeah, you know, I think that's absolutely right. That's one of the things that has struck me. As I mentioned to you before this interview, I'm an officer in the Navy Reserves now. I was prior enlisted in the Army, and one of the things I noticed, even, and I was a linguist, and so that's obviously entailed a lot of joint work. And one of the things I noticed about naval, and I would include Marines in this, Marines and sailors, both compared to airmen and soldiers, was they always seem to be doing a lot more in peacetime than we did. The last 20 years, I think people kind of think of the Army and in the Marine Corps as well for ground fighting. They don't think of the Navy as being in combat. But as you mentioned in the book, you know, one of the striking differences between the Navy and the Air Force and the Army is that there is really a strong key role for the Navy in peacetime. And beyond that, there's actually a non-military role for the Navy in terms of its support of commerce. So I was wondering if you could just kind of discuss that. Like, why is the Navy important for commerce, and what kinds of things does it do for us aside from fighting wars?
Well, I mean, well, for Mann, it's how we, it's, excuse me, he says that the chief thing that qualifies a people, he spends a lot of time in his writings trying to figure out which societies, which countries, which societies have the right stuff to take to the sea. And as, in a sense, he says it's a good thing to come from a resource poor country, because that compels you, if you want to become rich and do things in the world that you deem worthwhile, having a resource poor country drives you to the sea. If Great Britain, for example, which he depicts as the gold standard for sea power, which it was in his time in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Britain was fairly resource poor. Britons had to go to sea and trade if they wanted to become wealthy, including to make enough money to pay for a navy to support all this sort of trade. So I call it a virtuous cycle that Mahan sees in maritime strategy, whereby in essence, you go to sea, you stitch together what they call the supply chain, or what he called the chain of sea power. Today we would call the supply chain between distribution at home, shipment over the sea, and then having access to seaports on the far end, so that foreign customers can buy your wares to satisfy their wants and needs. This obviously back in Mahan's day, it was a little bit different how governments derived the revenue. They derived revenue directly from trade. Today it's a little bit different, but nonetheless we know that foreign commerce is what makes a nation rich, and the federal government gets that revenue stream, not so much out of tariffs and whatnot, but out of corporate income taxes and things like that. So I think the basic logic that Mahan sees in commercially driven sea power is still there. It almost seems like he turns our common understanding of sea power on its head. He says you need access. If you want to do all this stuff, you need access to foreign soil. But he's actually very clear about what types of access and what the relative importance among those types of access is. Commerce is king for him. So you need commercial access so that your firms can go overseas and do trade and all these wonderful things, generate that wealth. But after that, you need diplomatic representation, so political representation. So you need ambassadors and so forth. But you need that purely to facilitate commerce. And then only then do you need military access. Military access, naval access enhances prospects for diplomatic representation, which in turn serves commerce. So once you have that cycle of sea power going, at that point, once you're generating that revenue, that actually gives you the money to pay for a navy to safeguard trade. So again, Mahan sees a supply chain, a commercial supply chain that essentially has its own guardian in the form of a navy, and the money helps fund the naval protector for trade. So again, I call it a virtuous cycle, and Mahan certainly sees it as the foremost task of statecraft for the leaders of a commercially ordered and seafaring republic like the United States. So again, it feels like a cycle that should be churning into the indefinite future, as long as you want to remain a prosperous seafaring nation.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting in thinking about it practical terms. You know, we, as a soldier and dealing with ground forces, you often hear things kind of represented in a negative sense, like the warfighter is about lethality, is about overcoming the enemy, is about destruction, it's about, you know, winning wars, fighting battles. And so, like I said, it's kind of negative. It's a destructive goal, which I think is appropriate for the context that the Army operates in. It sounds like the Navy has that goal in wartime, but often has a more positive goal in terms of constructing something. And so I was wondering if you could, you know, what your thoughts about that was, and as well, if you could talk a little bit more about what are some of the differences between the strategic thinking that's suited for land engagements for armies and the kind of strategic thinking and planning that we really need to have when we consider maritime strategy.
Yeah, I think you're right to say that. You know, yeah, I guess you would say that navies and Marine Corps do have positive that sort of building function. And if you think about it, if we're doing naval diplomacy, maritime diplomacy all the time, even in peacetime, a lot of it's about building relationships and preserving relationships. If we want to, for example, I do Asia work predominantly. If we want to keep our relationship with allies such as Japan, strong. Well, we need to impress upon the Japanese, on our Japanese audiences, that we are a trustworthy partner. We're able to keep over our commitments to them. We are able to actually overcome our adversaries in wartime. If we are able to make that sort of impression on our allies, they will have confidence in us, and that confidence will lead them to keep up their end of the bargain. If should we get into a fight with a China or a Russia or whoever the case may be. So I would describe a lot of it as relationship building as well. And obviously there's a lot of non-combat functions that actually go along with that. I mentioned humanitarian relief, policing for the sea for a proliferation of guns and weapons of mass destruction and so forth. So there's a lot of constabulary stuff that goes along with the diplomatic aspects and the humanitarian aspects. As far as what differentiates different types of military services and military power, I usually reach back to Admiral Wiley, who was actually here in Newport on the War College faculty and staff in the 1940s and 1950s. We wrote a wonderful short book, even shorter than mine, called Military Strategy. But this is actually a question that he takes on almost as an aside in that particular book. He says that people who come to the profession of strategy from different services, they think differently. They bring different assumptions to the practice of strategy operations and tactics. For example, a ground warfare person would tend to assume that you have to win a big land engagement before you can actually start exploiting the fruits of victory, whether it's taking charge of an enemy's national life, as he called it, economically or whatever. And so on and so forth. That's different from an air power officer. Wiley contends that air power people come to the practice of strategy, assuming that destroying something from the air is how you control it. And he thinks that's a flawed assumption. But nonetheless, it seems to be sort of woven into how aviation services do things. Of course, Wiley is a naval officer. He actually thinks that. Sea services think in terms of winning command of the sea. You can start applying pressure on your adversary's national life from day one, even before you have a big naval battle and win command of the sea. So again, that's a bit of a different way of thinking. And Wiley's he actually undertakes this because he almost seems to despair of our ability to actually have debates about joint strategy and actually do more than reach the common denominator or the lowest common denominator. So he goes through and he actually pauses that there may be a fundamental assumption that we can all agree on that would give us a more fruitful ability to negotiate on strategy. He posits that it's indirection, that the concept going back to Sun Tzu in ancient China, as mediated by B.H. Littlehart in the early 20th century. Never have known whether I entirely sign on to that, but I think he's certainly right that we need to look for a common vocabulary of strategy if we want to improve the practice in the making of strategy among different services. I would say it's increasingly important today out in the maritime domain, simply because land forces and ground-based air forces can now reach far out to sea. I'm not sure if I've ever talked anybody into believing this, but I actually think that the United States Army is a maritime service. The United States Air Force is a maritime service as well, given that they're going to be doing a lot of stuff in the Western Pacific in particular, but certainly out at sea.
The Army has been working on some missiles and artillery pieces, I think, that are supposed to have some water reach, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. The Army and the Marines have been. It's actually kind of a beautiful thing to see the Army re-embrace that maritime past. I mean, sometimes you'll get an Army officer who will remind you that certainly in absolute terms, the Army did more amphibious stuff in the Second World War in the Pacific than the Marines did, just because it's a much bigger service. General MacArthur commanded one of the major offensives towards the Philippines. Very nautical service, and I think the Army is. Perhaps as a matter of institutional self-preservation, is actually regaining that maritime past. But yes, they've certainly just set out to equip themselves with a variety of missile artillery. Basically for use on Pacific Islands along the first island chain that stretches from Japan on south. This is where we think the fight that may come up. And I think that, and I think the Army has embraced that. The Air Force is now doing stuff like arming its bombers with sea mines, anti-ship missiles of various types, and so forth. So again, the Air Force, I would say, falls into that category as well.
Yeah, I think it's funny. One of the things I would point out when I was back in my days when I was not in the Navy was that there was the biggest amphibious operation in history was there were no Marines involved in it. And I think maybe this is an army propaganda, but I was always told that there were no landings in the South Pacific that did not involve at least one soldier. So I think that it's interesting too. There's an article in the Proceedings. I was just reading it last night, discussing it's the same issue that your essay appears in, discussing advanced base operations in the early 20th century. And something that struck me there was a sentence there said, in a testament to joint integration, two Marine officers were sent to the Army School for Submarine Defenses at Fort Monroe, Virginia, which was news to me. I assume that school must have closed down a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it must have. You know, it's actually, there's really a lot of value. I mean, obviously history is an invaluable wellspring of insight and ideas, but really a century ago, I think that interwar era, I think is especially fascinating because of all the intellectual ferment that went on in the Navy and our sister services with regard to war with Japan or whatever the next big thing would be. In fact, I would describe the Marines certainly at that time as the most intellectual of the services. They really set out to learn the lessons and codify the lessons that they learned from the Banana Wars in the 20s and 30s, from the Philippine War at the turn of the century. All these things fit into Marine doctrine. Marines published a wonderful book in 1935 called the Small Wars Manual, which is still in print today. And I think still informs how we do counterinsurgency in the maritime domain. So, there's certainly a lot of grist for learning about strategy today by looking in the rearview mirror. And I think that's a particularly fruitful era.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it's pretty incredible. And I also think, we were talking a little bit before the interview about groupthink in the DOD in general. And I think one of the things that was interesting then, I can't remember where I read this, or maybe it was an interview. Discussing some of the differences between the interwar period and officer formation and career paths and the ones today. And, I think it's kind of funny. There's a lot of positive reinforcement for education, that kind of thing today, which is good. I'm not saying that's negative, but, one of the theories I heard for the reason why you had so many officers with unusual careers, I mean, you can think of Stillwell, for example, a four-star general who spent a lot of time in China as a diplomat. Yep. Early in his career, which would be impossible for, I think, someone to reach that rank today and have spent that amount of time not in the command track. And so, I heard one of the arguments for that was actually that it was such a backwater professionally that people kind of did whatever the hell they wanted because they were probably going to retire as a major.
Yeah. Promotions were certainly slow as molasses in the interwar era. I would say that's probably a reasonable thing. It's actually kind of interesting to look back at some of the greats of the U.S. Navy and see how many of those people. I think this is a related phenomenon. Some of those people went to different communities, if not all the communities between the subsurface and the service community, and of course the aviation community. Admiral Nimitz started off life as a submariner, and of course ended up being a surface sailor before he rose to flag rank. Admiral King, who was our CNO during the Second World War, actually got his aviator's wings very late in life, as did Halsey, I think. So yeah, we definitely were not nearly as stratified as we are today. It would almost be unthinkable to do that kind of thing today.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine. Along with that, think about things that are hard to imagine and drawing from the past. Another thing that I have long thought about, especially, in my transition from ground forces to naval forces is, so many people think of naval threats as past, as something that hasn't happened or that's not going to happen, basically. I think it's kind of an end of history thing. And they have a hard time as a result conceptualizing, one, what naval warfare will look like. And that's a tactical question, which, you know, feel free to answer. But also on the strategic level, like what would the world be like without an American Navy? You know, I mean, I think people assume that if the Navy weren't there, things would kind of keep going because pirate ships are, maybe there's a couple of Somalis in a skiff somewhere in the, you know, in the Red Sea, but there's certainly no one around now that's going to be doing real piracy. So what would the world be like without an American Navy? What does the American Navy do for us in those terms?
Yeah, I think you're right to call attention to the constabulary tasks. Piracy, obviously, it's actually on the decline in the Western Indian Ocean, but I don't have a clear sense of how bad it is, but certainly the Gulf of Guinea has a piracy problem as well in the South Atlantic. So it never really goes away. In fact, if you read Thucydides and his History of the Peloponnesian War starts off by reviewing so. Farther back into Greek history, he actually contends that the first Greek navy was actually founded to combat piracy in the dim mists of time. So again, navies have that sort of constabulary function. If we did not maintain a navy here in the United States, that would be a really hard thing to envision. But I would assume that we would cede that part of the international system to somebody who did actually invest in the Navy, whether it's the European Union, whether it's China, obviously has put a lot of resources into its Navy over the last quarter century and so forth. So
the Chinese shipbuilding rates are pretty incredible over the last few years.
They certainly are. In fact, I find their buildup rather impressive. Rather impressive. It's extremely impressive what they've managed to do. They essentially started from almost zero in the mid 1990s, resolved to build the Navy, and a quarter century later have actually made it happen. Now, not to make this a China talk, but one thing for readers to think about is yes, the Chinese Navy, when you see pictures of their ships, they actually look a lot like ours. They look extremely impressive and well kept and so forth. But in a sense, they're black boxes. In that we can't really peek inside them. We can see the outward appearance of China's Navy, but we don't really know whether they've actually staged a leap to parity with us technologically, or whether they're a generation behind, or perhaps even more. That actually makes a big difference in who is the stronger force. The Soviet Navy was always much more numerous than we were, certainly by the 1970s and 80s. But at the same time, nobody would have said the Soviet Navy was the superior combat force. So that's a way to think about naval power, is that don't get too obsessed with the bean counting aspects of it, but actually ask the harder questions about who is actually stronger than whom. So that's a, and, let's see. Could you go back? I went off on a tangent there. We started talking about. I'm sorry. Yes, I remember that. We were gonna talk about why we were so hard to envision what naval warfare would look like today. Part of it is because you mentioned the end of history. I literally saw the United States Navy tell itself that the end of history had arrived in 1992. Strangely enough, the year that Frank Fukuyama published his famous book, The End of History. The Navy and the Marine Corps essentially said naval history had ended. That was the year when they issued their first effort at post-Cold War strategy, a document called From the Sea. And in the preamble, to that document, it specifically says, we own the sea. The Soviet Navy is gone. There's nobody else to challenge us for command of the sea. And therefore, we can restructure ourselves as a fundamentally different naval service, essentially a service that does not have to fight for maritime command because nobody will challenge it. That actually made sense for a while in the 1990s because the Soviet Navy was gone, Russia was in turmoil, China had not yet set on its naval buildup. But at the same time, if you tell yourself that your primary mission, fighting for command of the sea, is no more, well, what do you do? The Navy essentially stopped doing more than perfunctory efforts to keep up its proficiency at surface warfare, anti-air warfare, all the things you have to do to fight a peer navy. And if you do that for long enough, then you almost have a hangover. It's really hard to get back into a rhythm and start thinking in battle-minded terms. And that's kind of where we are right now. I think we're still getting over that end of history thinking. And I think we've lagged up until recent years just because we spent so much time assuming that we owned the seat and that we would never have to fight for command of it. I mean, it's really simple things. Like, I mean, you mentioned missiles. We used to have a Tomahawk anti-ship missile when I was on sea duty, which has been a while back now. We actually dismantled the inventory of Tomahawk anti-ship missiles and left ourselves with no long-range anti-ship missile, something that's at a premium in naval warfare today. We're now having to try to reinvent that maritime strike Tomahawk. It is actually happening. I mean, that's the good news, is some of these things are coming to fruition. But we got a very late start, as we saw China start to make itself a contender of note, as the Russian Navy started to get its mojo back and so forth. So again, very, very, very dangerous ever to tell yourself, and especially to instruct the service, that your primary mission is no more, and that you can stop preparing for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. We've been in kind of a weird situation for the last 30 years. I think, you know, there's traditionally a dichotomy drawn in historical military history and strategic terms between land powers and sea powers. And, you know, I think we, in many ways, the United States, and it has been in the past, you know, the first real military force that we built up was the Navy. And for a variety of reasons, including, you know, security ones, the argument in the early Republic was often that a Navy was better for a Republic to have than the Army, because the Navy couldn't go beyond the shores and attack its own people. And so we first built up the Navy. We had, you know, huge maritime industry for a long time. And then in the last 30 years, I think we've kind of forgotten about with air power and the kind of transit that we have. And I think people forget how much we relied on the sea to actually move materiel over to the Middle East. But we kind of look at the sea, I think, as a place that we skip over in order to perform military operations, which, again, like I said, is interesting compared to our history. So one of the things that I'd like to ask you, Professor Holmes, is the United States a land power or a sea power?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure there's actually a fixed answer to it, but it is a debate that's ongoing. Mahan contends that a nation can be both, but not for very long. He doesn't think that any nation could stand up to the rigors of funding great sea power and great land power at the same time. I think that it would be interesting to if we could conjure him up today and ask him what he thinks about the United States today, because I think we certainly qualify as both. But in a sense, it's a historical accident and an accident of geography, where we oftentimes say the United States can be a land power because it has a weak neighbor to the north, weak neighbor to the south, and also friendly neighbors, water to the left, water to the right. So in a sense we don't have those burdens that go along with being a land power. As China does, obviously, with lots of neighbors, as Russia does, as most nations do that live in a tougher neighborhood than we do. So in a sense, the United States can have it both ways. I think if you consider China, we oftentimes describe it as a hybrid land sea power, just because of the geography, sitting in the rimlands of East Asia, bordering India, bordering a lot of nations with some very formidable militaries and some of them nuclear armed as well. So in a sense, China has it a lot tougher than we do as it tries to go out to sea. China also has a geographic problem simply because as it tries to go to sea, simply because it has the first island chain that runs parallel to the coast more or less is all inhabited by U.S. friends and allies. So essentially, China faces a lot more difficult problem than the United States does trying to get out to sea. We can think about access to foreign coasts. We don't have to worry about getting out to sea, coming out of Norfolk, Virginia, or San Diego, or wherever. China has to worry about access from the time a ship casts off lines in Shanghai or whatever seaport you pick, getting out into the Pacific Ocean, into the Western Pacific Ocean. So there's sort of two hybrid land sea powers as well. I guess probably the quintessential land power would be Russia, but at the same time, I think that's probably changing as well, or at least potentially changing with climate change making those waters along Russia's northern periphery accessible, and thus letting Russia carry on commerce at sea and also do naval stuff at sea as well. So I'm not a big believer in that sharp dichotomy between land powers and sea powers. I do think most nations are more or less hybrids of one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting point. Yeah, I would kind of be inclined to agree with that. But, you know, one of the things that enables either maritime prowess alone or kind of the joint aspect is something you cover in the book, which is a culture or a spirit that, you know, lends itself to going towards the sea. And, you know, I think, and again, this has changed not necessarily just as a result of the Navy, but also as a result of technology. You know, in the past, you could think of port cities like Boston, Savannah, where I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. You know, that not that Jacksonville, Florida really was a port back in the day, but it is a port now. You know, and old ports had, the port was really integrated into the city itself, like Newport, for example. You know, most of Newport is situated right along what used to be a busy merchant port. Nowadays, you know, these ports are often removed from cities. No longer are shipping concerns really family businesses. They're often, you know, corporations that people don't really necessarily have a direct connection to. When you ship goods overseas, you don't really need to go talk to any of the shippers themselves. You can kind of do freight contracts at arm's length. So I was wondering, you know, what impact does this have on maritime culture, both in general and in the United States? Is maritime culture the same that it is now as it was yesterday? And does the U.S. maintain the same kind of maritime culture that it once had?
Yeah, I think the answer is, yeah, I would be prepared to say no. I actually don't think it is. It's seawater actually runs through our veins in the way it did maybe a century ago, or certainly after the Second World War. I mean, this is again. Mahan talks about maritime culture. I mean, he talks about all these tenets that make that qualify a nation to go to sea, and one of them is he calls it the character of the people. As you point out, the sea feels rather remote. Even right here, I live less than a mile from the water. I go walk along the Narragansett Bay just about every day. But again, it does feel rather impersonal. Ships come up to the Port of Providence, right past the house, more or less. They moor at various piers. You never see sailors out in town. They just basically stay on the ship. And so again, there's not that sort of mingling that spreads seafaring culture and also allows for cultural interaction with sailors who actually crew those ships. So I think it actually is a problem. But I mean, but if it's a problem along the coast, if it's a problem here in Newport, Rhode Island, or like you said, in Jacksonville, places like that. Think about it in the deep end of the heartland of the country. Think about I was out to Kansas City to the National World War I Museum to give a talk on the armistice a couple of years ago. Loved Kansas City. I thought it was a great town, but it really made me feel uneasy to be that far from the ocean. Yes, you have the Missouri River and so forth, which is nice. But wow, how much maritime consciousness is there going to be for somebody deep in the heartland who never even sees the ocean, and who doesn't really have much relationship to it? I mean, I think if you ask a person like that, is the Navy important? They would probably say yes, but they're not going to really feel it in their guts. So I think that, and I think that's a real problem. So just being the size of the United States and having so many different regions, many of them far from the sea, I think it actually makes it a tough sell as far as continuing a maritime culture. China's another thing because they have a very, very single-minded leadership that is very, very targeted on the sea. And obviously it's an authoritarian society that's able to put matters in front of the people and insist that they take note. We don't really have that. And I think that's a dangerous thing. I will say this, not just the United States, though, even Australia, even Great Britain itself, once the gold standard for sea power, leadership there oftentimes complains about what they call sea blindness, basically relying on the sea without actually taking it seriously that you need to do things, field the Navy to take care of the sea and make sure that maritime highway is always open. So I guess the short answer, no, I don't think we have the same maritime culture. What's the response? I mean, how do we do it better? I think that's kind of where the debate is, and I'm not entirely sure that I know the answer either.
Yeah, and what, you know, so and what impacts has this decline in the maritime spirit had on our naval forces in general? You know, I mean, you mentioned some concerns about, you know, lack of government support, lack of popular support in the imagination, but, you know, how have we seen that manifest itself in the actual naval forces of this country?
You could sort of come at it from the governmental angle. I mean, it's certainly you don't have all that many Navy veterans in Congress anymore. That makes it a little more difficult to reach out to lawmakers and convince them that that what we are asking for in budgets and in fleet design plans, all these sorts of things are actually important. That's a point that Admiral Wiley makes in his book in a different discussion from when he was talking about the Air Force culture and so forth. He actually points out, he says, look, you military people, you naval people, when you go to talk to lawmakers, you had better not use a lot of jargon. I mean, don't use this insider language, because in effect, you will be keeping secrets from them, keeping secrets from people who make strategic decisions through the budgetary process all the time. So as you can imagine, as you have fewer and fewer John McCains in Congress or other Navy veterans in Congress, that prospect for Congress people not to get what you're talking to them about is even more so. So I think that would be certainly one problem. Obviously, popular support for the Navy, people will tend to put a social program, you know, put their favorite social programs or whatever their domestic priorities are, over funding a Navy that's able to actually go out to sea and win command of the sea. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, what do you do every day? You go to work, you try to make a living for your family, you hope for security and so forth. These are the things that are going to, they're going to rank higher on your personal priority than something that feels kind of, it's obviously out of sight for the, unless you live in a vibrant naval port and you assume that it's always there. Common talking point for Navy leaders is that the Navy is sort of like oxygen. You don't notice it until you don't have it, and at that point, you really need it badly.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's also a broader strategic consequence, which, you know, I know is often written about among naval thinkers today, that I'd love for you to elaborate on it. Which is, you know, its effect on commerce, you know, the decline in merchant shipping, and not just merchant shipping, but civilian ship capacity. Is that something, you know, in terms of fewer merchant mariners, fewer American flag vessels, this, that, and the other? I mean, is that part of a naval maritime concern? And how do strategists, or how should strategists, think about merchant shipping and potentially America's lack thereof?
Yeah, it's a real problem in a lot of ways. I would say the sort of the immediate thing is, yes, we need merchant seafaring. I mean, we need demographically speaking, we need a vibrant maritime community. So people who are skilled in shipbuilding, obviously who actually go out and drive ships around and carry goods overseas, do all these things that commercial seafaring involves. If you don't have that, I mean, there's going to be a carryover effect on your ability to build and maintain a Navy and operate that Navy proficiently. So in a sense, that sort of demographic decline of that community in the United States is a real problem. The more immediate operational problem is that we always say the Navy only plays away games. We fight off the rimlands of East Asia or Western Europe, whatever the case may be, perhaps even in South Asia today. And it takes a lot of shipping to get stuff and people to theaters of conflict. It's kind of hard to get a firm number on the numbers of merchant marine hulls that we actually have available to us to carry war material and people. But it appears to me that we have fewer ships that are actually available for sea lift today than were damaged or sunk during the first year of World War II out in the Atlantic in 1942. So if you assume that a China or a Russia or some other adversary is going to try to obstruct our ability to get material into the theater, and that's exactly what they will do, then I think we have to expect that we will suffer casualties, and we really need to bulk up that merchant fleet, or else we simply won't be able to get it done if we get in the scrap in a faraway theater like Asia or Europe. So So it's sort of the cultural aspect and then the operational aspects, and both I think were wanting.
Yeah, and I think that's a wonderful illustration of your discussion about the virtuous circle or cycle, the other side of it. You know, on the one hand, people like Mahan were really thinking about how the Navy pushes forward commerce and supports commerce. But, you know, the flip side of it is with the maritime spirit, commerce really inculcates that maritime spirit and lets people know why they should care about the Navy, you know, and causes more naval veterans to be in public places and, you know, advertises what the Navy really does for them. And so it's kind of a deflationary cycle almost in terms of the decrease of merchant shipping.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think this is actually, we were talking about the end of history a little while ago. I think this is actually a related phenomenon, and this is a non-strictly naval thing. I think American society actually succumbed to that sort of end of history thinking as well. In fact, I started studying international relations, as I mentioned, in the early 1990s, right after the Cold War. And I remember when I started going into classes, and people would say, yeah, geography doesn't matter, force doesn't matter, everything is commerce today. I think that the United States, I think Americans were not especially geographic thinkers in general, but I think we actually made it much worse. If you would have a very distinguished scholar saying that, hey, it's a globalized age, geography no longer matters. And geography obviously includes the sea, which covers most of the globe as well. So I think we've as a society, as well as the Navy, I think we're actually making a return to history. You don't find people saying that kind of thing anymore, but that was really in the air. I would say certainly up until the turn of the century, and probably far after that. I remember having a back and forths in print with pretty distinguished people about whether geography matters. It's obvious to military and naval people that it does, but it's kind of easy for people who do not go out and serve in the armed forces. It's kind of easy to say that kind of stuff. And there's actually political and strategic implications to that sort of blind spot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a famous article, the geographical importance of power. I mean, it was the turn of the 20th century, right? I think it was 1890s, 1910.
Yeah, McKinder. Yeah.
So just in case anybody is not fully convinced, what is the importance of geography in terms of both maritime strategy and otherwise?
Well, I mean, President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, he started off his fireside chats during World War II by asking Americans to take out their atlas. He would always say, look at your map, especially in his famous fireside chat on Washington's birthday in 1942, which of course will be, we are commemorating tomorrow. So, he fervently believed that looking at the map is the way to gain wisdom and strategy. He would essentially ask Americans to look, and he would show how we were going to try to, or he would show the danger of the Axis actually potentially encircling the United States from Europe and Asia, and he would basically just in very simple terms put it to them. He was probably the most geographically minded president that I know of. Theodore Roosevelt, I guess, would fall into that category as well. But yeah, so there are big figures who testified to the importance of geography. But I mean, again, so just pull out get out your globe and look at the globe and think about how hard it is to try to wage war in China's backyard, where China has all the advantages that go to the home team, especially if you have to cross 6,500 miles of water and probably face opposition even as you go. When you leave Honolulu or when you leave San Diego, you're going to face opposition from China's military long before you get to the combat zone, whether it's the Taiwan Strait or so forth. Think about how hard it is for us to go and preserve Taiwan's independence in the Taiwan Strait, only about 90 miles from mainland China. That right there shows exactly how difficult this practice of strategy, force design, all of these things are. So,
I think you've been mentioning Taiwan there as a perfect example of something that you started talking about earlier too. Is, you know, and with China, it cuts both ways. I think not to excuse China's actions in the South China Sea, but I think it becomes a lot more reasonable when you, as you mentioned, you look around and you see how hemmed in they are by our allies, by powers that are not necessarily friendly to China, and that in some cases like Vietnam are becoming potentially less friendly to China as time goes on. You can really understand, I think, from a geographic perspective, why they want to push out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you look at, again, going back to looking at the map, the first island chain, there is no Chinese seaport that outflanks the first island chain. That's one reason that all the way back to the Cold War, but I think you're seeing a renewal of this this idea that we can use the island chain, use military forces on the island chain to apply commercial and military pressure on China. And obviously, China is very cognizant of that. It's first island chain stares them in the face every time, every day when they get up in the morning and look eastward out to sea. So, I don't think you need to have sympathy with our potential enemies, let alone with anybody else, but you certainly do have to have a measure of empathy. Try to see the world the way that they do, and that helps you get some glimpse of what they might do in the future to try to beat this strategy.
So this next question will be one of our last. It might be an unfair one because it is outside of your realm of expertise, but it kind of came to my mind while you were talking. You know, I certainly remember, and I assume you probably were of this inclination when you were a much younger person, you know, being I wouldn't even say young man, a boy, and pulling out, I don't know, whether it was the encyclopedia or an actual atlas or just maps and looking at maps and kind of thinking about, you know, just not even thinking seriously about places, but, you know, just kind of, you know, like, oh, I wonder what that place is like, and, you know, just kind of looking at where things are. And I, you know, with the internet now and the way we access maps, and I'd be curious to know how many people actually do that. I bet you a lot of people don't. Do you think that has any impact on some of these issues of strategy and conceptions, geography? The fact that when we do interact with maps, it's not often by looking at a whole map and trying to find your way through the map and locating yourself in a broader perspective, but it's more like plugging coordinates into a GPS or addresses and just getting out, getting directions and not really seeing or reading a news article and just kind of seeing here's the city and not seeing the context. Do you think that has any impact on the way we conceptualize these problems today?
Yeah, I think you're onto something. I mean, it's very. I mean, I could call up Google Earth on my laptop in about 30 seconds. It's right on my desktop. So obviously, we do have a lot of cartographic information right in front of us. So you, I mean, it's great. You can measure distances and whatnot right there on your desktop. But I think it might be perhaps even a deeper issue than that. I don't know about you, anywhere. I'm just spitballing here at this point, but I certainly find that reading a physical book is very different. I read on the Kindle as well, and obviously read the internet and all that kind of stuff. I don't find it to be the same thing, and I actually don't. It doesn't seem like it really stays with me the same way. Picking up a physical book, an atlas in this case, if we're talking about geography, and just sitting there and studying, I think that psychologically, it registers with you more. I don't even know how exactly to say it, but I've noticed this over the years. If I'm studying a book, if I want to put it in my intellectual capital for the future, I always get the physical book. If it's just for entertainment, I do Kindle or whatever, just because you don't really care about it. But I do think that there's sort of a staying power to physical products, including atlases, that helps you really feel it in your guts. Geographic relationships to one another. Nicholas Spykman, by the way, if anybody really wants to study geography, you could not do better than go to his books from during the World War II era, The Geography of the Peace, and also America's Strategy in World Politics. He draws a lot of these geographic relationships out. He also says you just have to remind yourself once in a while. You need to go and look at the globe once in a while just to refresh basic geographic concepts in your mind. For example, and he gives the example of the fact that the vast majority of South America lies east of Washington, D.C. I certainly have a very vertical understanding of Western Hemisphere geography, and that just doesn't make a darn bit of sense to me. But it's actually true. So if you go to Rio de Janeiro, which I had the good fortune to do a couple of years ago, you actually go forward in time or in time zones, and not just stay in the same time zone. So kind of fascinating.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, another one of those little factoids that is interesting. I mean, this you don't necessarily get from an atlas, but, you know, London is several hundred miles closer to New York City than New York City is to LA, you know, which is also something that I, you know, when you talk about things like the Two Coast Navy, which we don't unfortunately have enough time to get into, but, you know, it has interesting consequences for that, I think.
Yeah, it's I mean, yeah, I guess we are starting to wind down on time, but Spikeman points out, and he's trying to impress upon us the importance of geography. And yeah, he contended that when the Panama Canal opened in 1914, 1915, he points out that in a sense, in a commercial sense, that it was not only a game changer for the Navy, letting us swing fleets back and forth between the Atlantic and the Pacific much more easily, but also from a commercial standpoint, all of a sudden New York City, our dominant seaport at the time, is closer to Shanghai or to North China rather than Liverpool, the major British trading port, and obviously New York's major competitor. So in a sense, digging that canal teleported New York City by steaming miles far closer to East Asia, which was thought to be fantastically wealthy and a great place to trade. So, and he points out there was a cultural impact to that as well. The United States, because of our heritage, has always looked towards Europe. All of a sudden, the canal has transformed the Caribbean into a maritime highway. All of a sudden, Americans are also looking south, and thence towards the Pacific to the west. So again, changing geography is obviously a big deal as well. Suez Canal, same deal.
Yeah. And so like I said, unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I guess my last question to you, Professor Holmes, would be if you were, I won't even say Chief of Naval Operations, if you became the Secretary of the Navy, Joe Biden's new Secretary of the Navy, what are some of the initiatives that you would do to either ensure that people are more aware of maritime strategy or to shore up our position, vis-a-vis the maritime domain?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to become Secretary of the Navy. Nobody's asked. So, in fact, you don't want me to try to run the Navy. I haven't run anything big in a very long time. But we are actually, you mentioned the proceedings, the current issue of the Naval Institute proceeding. We're actually making an attempt to get the word out, certainly within the services, and to help service people, Marines and naval officers and enlisted, to help them become good spokesmen for the Navy. In hopes that the word will seep out as they interact with their fellow citizens out in town on deployment or whatever. So we're doing something called the American Sea Power Project, which is an effort to carry on a year-long conversation in print about the importance of a great Navy. We have a pretty good lineup of people whom you've heard of who are going to weigh in. But I think that's going to be helpful. Personally, we need to make an effort to get sea power back into the popular culture. I mean, that's where you could possibly really have an impact. I would think there are certainly books about the Second World War in the Pacific sell like hotcakes. You know, you have Ian Toll, you have James Hornfisher. These guys are great storytellers. We need people who are great storytellers to help get the word out. But I would actually take it even farther than that and try to get fiction writers in on it. I mean, think about the impact that C.S. Forrester had on public opinion in Great Britain during the Second World War, simply because he was a gifted storyteller. People in Britain loved a good story about the sea. And if you have a Joseph Conrad, if we had great fiction writers out there in the public today who could actually just get that back into the zeitgeist. I think that would actually help people. It would actually help them think about the Navy. If people think about the Navy, the chances are they're going to reach conclusions that are acceptable and provide their support to this vital effort that we're embarked upon.
That's great. Sparking the imagination. I like it.
That's a good
spot to end on. So just what I'd like to say, we mentioned the proceedings a couple of times in this interview. For people who may not know, the proceedings is it's a monthly magazine journal that is put out by the U.S. Naval Institute, which is run out of, I think, Baltimore. And it is a kind of gold standard for all maritime services, U.S. Coast Guard, Marine Corps, U.S. Navy, many other services, members of the other services read it regularly. If you are interested, it is not too expensive, and you should keep track of what's going on. You can just join up. Anyone can join the U.S. Naval Institute. All right, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's actually in Annapolis. So the building actually faces the U.S. Naval Academy. They actually run a good scholarly press as well, which is where I publish most of my books.
And as a small tidbit of information or a trivia, I guess they were the press that first published Hunt for Red October. So Tom Clancy's inaugural publisher was USNI.
Yeah, I don't think he could. I don't think Tom could find a publisher, and they did it, and they just made money hand over fist. Yeah, that was really a great get for them. Strangely, my very last time out at sea before coming to shore duty, Clancy actually came and rode on board. So it was kind of neat to meet him. He was kind of a fascinating guy because he wanted to hang out with the enlisted people. So he hung out in the chief's mess and places like that, and he kept us officers more or less at arm's length. But yeah, he was a good dude.
Yeah, that's a great story. All right, Professor Holmes. Well, I really certainly enjoyed the chat, and hopefully next time you publish a book, we will be able to invite you over and continue our conversation.
Yeah, I got another one coming later this year.
Oh, what's it about?
I've always wanted to write a little bit of philosophy, so I call it habits of highly effective maritime strategists. I start all the way with Aristotle and spend a lot of time with the philosophers, but basically make the case that strategy is a family of habits that we should all groom ourselves with in order to excel at the practice of strategy.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to reading it. All right. Thank you, Professor Holmes, and thank you for joining us today for a new book on the New Books Network.